Good evening. The general's given me first word here tonight. That's highly unusual. Usually the general officers speak first. My career started flying in Washington. I was chosen to go on a crew with Lyndon Johnson to a parliamentarian conference in Paris. Everybody said, Johnson always wants someone to go to the hotel with him to take care of him. And we heard he had a reputation of being pretty demanding, and none of us wanted to go. In those days, I was the lowest ranking guy, so I ended up going. Well, that established almost 10 years of my life working with him. I became his personal military aide and continued to fly on the aircraft. On that particular day in Dallas, in that tragic day, I was on Air Force Two. We went down on. We landed first. Air Force One pulled up, and everybody knows where they were at that time. But I'm going to talk a little bit about tonight some of the things we did on the airplane as we were finding out what was happening. We didn't know how serious it was. At first, we did not know the president was killed. We were getting information where Johnson was calling his staff to say, find out what was going on. We had never had a president sworn in on Air Force One. We didn't even have the correct words. One of Johnson's secretaries was calling back to the Attorney General's office, and Attorney General Bob Kennedy was at his own house. So he talked to Deputy Attorney General Katzenbach. At that point, they're taking down the words of how to swear in a president. Mrs. Kennedy then had made up her mind that she wasn't leaving Dallas without the president's body. So Johnson had set it up to call a Judge Sarah Hughes to have her come to the plane, and it was a Kennedy appointee as a federal judge to swear him in. The Kennedy people, still with Mrs. Kennedy, did not know this was taking place because the Deputy Attorney General says, we don't know how serious it is. We need a president in office regardless. So they told Johnson to get inaugurated on the airplane. In the meantime, we find out they're bringing the body with them out of Dallas. One of the sergeants on the airplane, Chief Master Sergeant Joe Chappell, decided we can't put the president's body in the belly with the luggage. We've got to do something. Joe, with Colonel Swindell's permission, who was the aircraft commander at that time, decided we better put it upstairs. So in a hurry, they ripped out four rows of seats. We had to take a partial wall down to get it into the airplane. And there's some real inside stories, if you ever tell stories about it, that you might know. Getting ready to come up the ladder, the Kennedy staff decided they would carry it up as an honor. We didn't have an honor guard there. Well, President Kennedy weighed about 170 pounds, and that casket weighed about 325 pounds. They couldn't lift it. Some of the crew members, we had to go down to help them carry it up the ramp. Going into the airplane, they broke one of the handles off of the casket. We put it there. By that time, Johnson's staff is finding what's going on in the back of the airplane, and he decided to see if we can get Mrs. Kennedy to come up to show the world there is continuity in the transition of the presidency. The Johnson staff, very, very quiet. The Kennedy staff staying in their area. Me being an Irish Catholic, I knew what the Kennedy staff were going to do. They're going to have a mini wake for you non-Irishmen back out there. That's a little heavy drink. That started. The Johnson people drinking coffee and consomme. And this is what we were going through. The Kennedy people felt the Johnson upstart of taking over the presidency, or actually Mrs. Kennedy, very, very stable, very, very calm. Johnson said, would you ask her if she'd come up front? And Kenny O'Donnell said, well, yes, we do it. And he said, well, the lady liked to change. She still had on that beautiful pink dress with all the stuff that was on the dress. She said, no, let them see what they have done. Well, that famous picture that we have where the swearing-in took place on Air Force One, which we'll put up for you if you want right now. This is the picture. And in that plane, you can still see her there. And I'll get them to take this and put it up a little bit. Just to give you an idea, and I want to bring it on so I can get the general in so we can talk about some other things we did. There wasn't animosity on the airplane like some books have said. There was this feeling of loss from the Kennedy side, this feeling of inaptness or being at the wrong place for the Johnson people. What a lot of people don't know, on Air Force Two going down, there was 32 people plus the crew. On Air Force One, there was 36 people plus the crew. So now you're going to compact both of those on Air Force One if this didn't work. Colonel Jim Swindell, who was the aircraft commander, says, Paul, you know some of the Johnson people. I know the Kennedy people. We've got to start fitting this out. We've talked about it since then. He and I decided to let one Army captain stay on board Air Force One. We don't know why we did. Cecil Stoughton, he was an official White House photographer. He's the gentleman that took this famous picture. Now, the way the room was set up, there was a couch around here, and he was standing up on the couch so he could get this shot down underneath him. So some things would say, why did this happen? Why it was just a series of things were happening as time was going down. I'll tell you another story that's a good one. You can tell people you know a little bit about what was going on. Kenny O'Donnell went into the president's stateroom, President Kennedy's stateroom, to look for a Bible. There was two beds in there and a little cubbyhole in between it. He reached down and picked up this book that was in a little box and brought it up and gave it to Judge Sarah Hughes. Judge Sarah Hughes holds it up and Johnson puts his hand up and he gets sworn in. What most of the public don't know, and it is the truth, that was a Catholic missal, which is the liturgy of the Catholic faith, how to study. That is now in the library of the Johnson Library in Austin, Texas. So that's some of the little things that we were talking about today that went on. It should be interesting to them. The wherewithal of what was going on the airplane, trying to find the right thing to say to the world that America was still in charge, we still knew what we were doing. And that time hit me. We had one master sergeant in the Air Force became the voice of the United States government. He was the radio operator on the airplane, was deciding which calls would come into the plane and which calls would go out. President Johnson then made a call to Rose Kennedy, the president's mother, to tell him how bad he felt about what went on. At the same time, Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, over the Pacific, they were heading to Japan. He's trying to get in. We have all this going on. This one master sergeant, so anybody don't think you're enlisted man in the middle of what's going on. He was the voice of the United States for almost 2 hours and 16 minutes on our flight back to Washington. And then we landed in Washington and Johnson went to the executive office building. My dilemma was my wife had watched all this on TV. We had a good friend of ours was Jerry Tippett, a Secret Service agent. She heard there was a Tippett on a plane that was killed, on the ground that was killed, a police officer. She thought, oh my, so they got Jerry Tippett. And Paul, in my level of rank, I wasn't being mentioned anywhere. So my wife, by after midnight, was sure that something was wrong with me because she always knew I was close to where Vice President Johnson was. In that time frame, we were at Johnson's house on 52nd Street. Actually, people might remember a name like Pearl Mesta. That was a previous house that she owned, a beautiful home out in Northwest Washington. We were there, and he was still trying to do the right thing to get the government to keep going, to get the military on the proper defense position, to find out if there was more to this. And then I finally got to go home, and I went back out to where I worked in the Air Force, and they sent me home and said, take the day off. I was no place to go. I couldn't go with the president because I didn't work for the president. I went back to my job. I got a phone call. Said, Paul, this is Lyndon Johnson. Where in the hell are you? I said, sir, I'm Air Force. I have to go back to my last command. He said, I need you more than ever. Get over here and get your ID card. And that's how I started flying with the president. And I had flown with Jim Cross long before that on a Jetstar with a good friend of ours who's no longer with us, Paul Thornhill's co-pilot. We flew all over the world, all over the United States at Ragged in that Jetstar. So we were a team that way. Well, I was so happy to see he got qualified and moved up on it. And that's almost, 45 years we've known each other?
About that.
Yeah. And I'm going to throw it over to you now. We're in the Johnson era.
I think what I would like to... Is that background noise from my mic?
No, I don't think so.
What I'd like to talk about, I'm sure that most of you who have heard of or read about Lyndon Johnson... I've heard that he was a tough, difficult man to get along with, and that's true. He could be very difficult to deal with every day, any day, or for that matter, in the middle of the night. And so first thing I'd like to do before I tell you a couple of stories about some of the things that happened to us in later years as we progressed over some 11 years, and his employee or his friend or whatever he considered us, I can't say that I was his friend, but I would like to read you a couple of excerpts from two different books that were written by some of his very close friends. The first of these is a book by, and this won't be, and I have to read it to be totally accurate, just a couple of pages, so it'll take a minute. And I hope that this will kind of set the stage for what some of the things Paul and I will talk about how difficult it could be to get along with Linda Johnson. This was written by a man named Jack Valenti. Jack Valenti is currently the president of the Motion Picture Association of the United States. And he was a very good friend, a longtime associate of the president. And he even ended up marrying the president's number one secretary.
Mary Margaret Wiley.
And the book is entitled, A Very Human President. And I quote Jack, he was an awesome engine of a man, terrorizing, tender, inexhaustibly energetic, ruthless, loving of land, grass, and water, engulfing, patient, impatient, caring, insightful, deceitful, devoted to wife, family, and friends, petty, clairvoyant, compassionate, bullying, sensitive, tough, resolute, charming, earthy. And I'm going to add just a little comment here. He was indeed earthy. Courageous, devious, full of humor, brilliantly intelligent, brutal, wise, suspicious, disciplined, crafty, generous. But he had just one goal, to be the greatest president, doing the greatest good in the history of the nation. Yet he had one great tragedy, a war he had inherited whose previous commitments he could not break and whose tenacity he did not pursue. Now, that's from a good friend of President Johnson. In fact, I saw him recently at a gathering at the LBJ Library in November, I believe, and we had a long conversation about the days that he had spent and Paul and I had spent with the president, and we reminded one another that he had been a pretty difficult human being to get along with, yet we all loved him. Now, the second I'm going to read for you is from a book by George Reedy. George Reedy was a special assistant, a longtime friend, worked in the White House as a press secretary for a while, was a speechwriter and advisor. And here's what George had to say. Now, keep in mind, this was a good friend of the president. As a human being, he was a miserable person. A bully, a sadist, a lout, and an egotist. His lapses from civilized conduct were deliberate and usually intended to subordinate someone else to his will. He did disgusting things because he realized that other people had to pretend that they did not mind. It was his method of bending them to his desires. If there were nothing else in the record to look at save LBJ's personal relationships with other people, it would be merciful to forget him altogether. But there is much more to look at. And I hope I don't offend anybody here, but the language gets just a little bit earthy. He may have been a son of a bitch, but he was a colossal son of a bitch. Nevertheless, he was capable of inspiring strong attachments, even with people who knew him for what he was. Now, did I mention what book that was from? I want to give you the title of it. A book by George Reedy entitled Lyndon B. Johnson, A Memoir. Now, I must say, though, that I think Paul and I both would agree that he wasn't a sadist or a lout. I really didn't consider him that last thing, that the colossal whatever it was. But he was an extremely difficult man to get along with, and those of us that served for him for a long time certainly understood that, and we realized, of course, that he was the President of the United States. He had to have an outlet at times because of the pressures he was under, because of the war that was going on, and all the flack that he was getting from the dissenters and the demonstrations that were going on around the world, and then they indeed in Washington, D.C. So those of us that were there understood that, well, we could take a little flack on, as fighter pilots call it, our 6 o'clock position and come back for more and not worry about it, because he only fired at the 6 o'clock of those that he apparently thought the most of. So that's the way we survived. Paul, you have anything you want to add?
I was going to add one in, another side of the man that people didn't see or didn't get in the press. Each of us that worked at the White House had a White House phone, usually in our bedroom, where he could get a hold of us anytime he wanted to. Well, one night, it was on my side of the bed, my wife answered the phone. He said, "Cookie," and that was my wife's nickname, "this is Lyndon Johnson, tell Paul to come on in the..." It's about 2 in the morning. "I need him right now, come on in." So I got in my car and went on in. And after we got there, he said, "Partner, get a hold of Rufus," that's Rufus Youngblood, was the Secret Service agent in charge, "and the boys," and that's what he called the rest of the Secret Service agents, "we're going to go to a church." He said, "Bob McNamara's told me he's sending about 150 men up over North Vietnam, and he thinks about 100 of them won't come back." But Johnson took McNamara's word. He was a statistician that knew what he was talking about. It so hit him that he wanted to go with some people who was close to him and pray. We found a Catholic church open. Johnson was a Southern Baptist, but he wanted to go where God was. We went in there. There's 5 of us men and probably 7 of the Secret Service agents in the back, sitting there praying, hoping something wouldn't happen. Well, that never got out in the public, and that's the kind of man he was. But he would use the people that was close to him to bring them in closer when he needed them. And that's what I remember. Yes, sir. They said there was about 90 lost. It did not hit McNamara's 100, but there was about 90 lost in that flight. Now, General Cross has flown over that area over there. He went when he left the White House, not because that's what they wanted to do, the ex-military aides. I also went to Vietnam after the White House. So we were military men, but he's flown over in that area and tell you it's not easy. We can show a couple of the pictures. I brought some pictures with us tonight. We were thinking coming out here, we're going to talk about Air Force One.
Go ahead and show those pictures, and then I want to tell a couple of stories that I think might be interesting and amusing to you about that kind of ties in what I read from the excerpts from these two books.
Here's a picture of 2-6000 in flight. That would be the ones you see. Just go on with the pictures. Leave them up long enough so they can see what they're doing. Here's another one in a different angle. Beautiful airplane. Before, on Air Force One, we had this ugly orange, which was an orange to be seen if you went down somewhere in the north where it was cold and white. President John Kennedy decided to change this color and put United States of America on it. Now, this is a very famous picture. Very few of those are available. I brought it out because I'm going to leave some of them here with the museum. That's John Kennedy leaving Andrews Air Force Base en route to Dallas. Now, you notice, in those days, they always went up the back part of the airplane. It started later on. After that, we started using the front entrance. This general area, this happened to be John Kennedy's naval aide, Tazewell Shepherd. This is yours truly right here. This is a gentleman that was driving the car in Dallas. These seats are the ones that we took out, and this wall up here is where we put the casket. I thought that'd be very helpful to the museum know exactly where it was. So I'm leaving that picture. They're going to make copies of it. One more, and then we'll go on what the general has to say with it. I just thought it'd be interesting to you to see some actual pictures. This one, he was talking about the Beagle Dogs before we came on. This is an arrival after November. We're down in Texas. That's me with the 2 Beagle Dogs, Johnson's dogs, him and her, which he loved. And this is Johnson and the base commander arriving in Texas. But we'll show some more, too.
Yeah. Johnson was also the kind of a man that liked to keep his options secret from everybody, including the appointee, whoever he was about to appoint to the Supreme Court or whatever. And I'll tell you a story about what happened to yours truly. We had been flying for him as vice president for about 2 years, and of course, once we were qualified in the big 707 after he became president, we started flying on the 707 and also the Jetstar whenever he wanted to go, whichever one he went on, well, that's the one we were on. But General Clifton, who had been held over from the Kennedy administration, an Army Major General, was about to retire from the Army. And so the scuttlebutt around Washington, and particularly in the Pentagon, was wonder who was going to be the new director of the military office in the White House and the military assistant to the president. And the speculation was it'd be some general, you know, that was politically correct for the job. And I'm going to let you tell something about this, and then I'd like to finish it.
Okay. But
go ahead.
One of the times that President Johnson was swimming down at the ranch, and he said, "Paul, what do you think of Jim Cross?" I said, "I've been flying with him for years. He's a very competent pilot, a good man, doesn't have a political axe to grind." I said, "He's loyal, and he likes doing what he's doing." He said, "What do you think of him in military aid?" We were staying at a house on the ranch.
The Jordan House.
All I could do was keep biting my knot, and I run down and say, "Hey, Jim, have I got something to tell you?" I couldn't do it. But the president had made that decision already, and he hadn't told General Cross.
Never mentioned it to me that I was going to be the replacement for Major General Chester Clifton.
Chester Clifton, yeah.
And so, and I want to get into another amusing aspect of the story in a moment. It was a couple of days after the announcement came out, and it was like a bombshell dropped on the Cross household to think that here we are living in a squadron at Andrews Air Force Base, and all of a sudden we're going to be moving into the White House in an office as head of the military office and Armed Forces Aid. And it was just unbelievable. It was unbelievable to the Pentagon, unbelievable to us. A couple of days later, when he finally got around to talking to us about it, he said, "Well, Cross, what did you think about my appointing you Armed Forces aide?" And I said, "Well, Mr. President, I don't even know how to spell it, sir." And he said, "You were here with us at the planting, and I wanted you to be here with us at the harvest." And he said, "However, you've got the damnedest mess in that military office over there that I've ever seen." He said, "You've got 2,000 people that work over there and claim they all work for the president." And we did have a rather large staff. We had the White House garage, which was 50 or 60 military people that worked over there, chauffeurs and mechanics and whatnot. We had the staff mess in the White House. We had the Camp David. We had the underground facilities, which you all have been hearing about recently as the shadow government. Yeah. That all came under the military office and so on. We had the airplanes, had the helicopters. Anyway, he said to me, "You've got 2,000 people over there." And by the way, he would oftentimes exaggerate if he wanted to make a certain point. And so when he said 2,000 people, I had no idea. In other words, until I got there, I had no idea. There might be 500, there might be 5,000. But as quickly as I could, I found out that we had about 1,100 people working for us. And he said, "I don't need all those people. What I want you to do is get rid of half your people." He said, "Don't fire anybody. Don't be holding any press conferences about what you're going to do." And he said, "Don't piss anybody off. Just get rid of half your people." And then he put one caveat on that. He said, "I'm going to give you 6 months, Cross, to get the job done. And if you can't do the job, I'm going to find somebody that can." Yes, sir.
He had a way of doing things like that. Well, we're shortly at the White House. I'm just learning to find my way around. He said, "Paul, down in South, where I come from, we have Royal Electrification. And if you kept your kilowatts down under a certain thing, you paid a minimum bill." He said, "This White House bill is too expensive." He said, "Now, you've heard of light colonels." He said, "I'm going to make you the light sergeant at the White House. Now, you go around to any office you want to and shut those damn electric lights down." Well, he passed that word out of staff meeting. When I start walking in the room, I got all the honors you want to see. Lights went out. But that's the kind of way he operated. He got you totally involved in what you were doing. But that's another story out of there. Let's show a couple more of the pictures.
Go. I want to tell the around the world story.
Oh, yeah, that's another one. That's wow. While this is coming up on this, this gentleman is the only man that ever flew a president around the world. And he'll tell you some of the hours and stuff we did it. Another side I always tell in the same story is we were the first to take a sitting president into combat since Roosevelt went into World War II in North Africa. We went into Cameron Bay in Vietnam twice with Air Force One. Most of the public hadn't even forgotten or remembered. This is another one inside of the airplane. This would be up in the stateroom. This was Chief Justice of the United States, another justice, Willard Wirtz, press secretary. The steward up there is an old friend of mine, Ken Gaddis, Jack Valeni, and Lem John, Secret Service agent. I brought that so they could see the expanse of what the plane was inside. Another one. Put one more in there. Now, this is where I was saying we picked up the Bible. There's two beds right here. Senator Fulbright, Tazewell Shepherd, the naval aide, Mike Mansfield, who was just recently deceased with us, the president, and myself. That Catholic missile, there was two beds here, was up on the table up in this area. That was the president's bedroom on Air Force One. So that's another good picture you guys can use here.
I might add, but Air Force One, every time the presidency changed, whoever the president was didn't like the interior like it was, and so they had it changed. So I don't know how many times it's been changed, but it was changed a bunch. Johnson told me that he didn't like the number of seats on board. He said, "I want a lot of seats on that airplane." And so when we gutted the interior from the Kennedy airplane out of it and put the Johnson interior in it, I think we had 105 seats in total.
Yeah. And we had them turned around, too.
Which, and they were facing rearward. And the reason for that, he wanted to... And we had a glass panel, which you could close off with curtains, to the stateroom. He would be in the stateroom in his, we called it the king chair.
King chair. We didn't do that in front of him. That was our inside.
That was inside, yeah. He would be sitting in what we called the king chair, and he might ask Paul or someone in the back of the airplane to move the curtains open if he had a bunch of press people on board or a bunch of congressmen.
Yeah.
They would all be facing him in... Three abreast seating, by the way, on either side. And then he would get on his microphone and make whatever points he wanted to make. And he said he wanted it that way with them facing rearward. And he said, "Will that work?" And I said, "As a matter of fact, it will, Mr. President, because the FAA thinks that rearward-facing seats are more safe than forward-facing seats. Because if you had a crash, you know, you'd have more strength in the back of that chair." Now let me start on the around the world trip. It was the occasion for this was when the Prime Minister of Australia, a man named Harold Holt, was drowned in a swimming accident on the coast of Australia. And President Johnson and Ms. Johnson were very good personal friends of Prime Minister Holt and Mrs. Holt, in addition to being political friends because of his being the Prime Minister. And so when the Prime Minister died in that accident, the first thing he did, I say the first thing, at least I thought it was the first thing, he might have called somebody else, but he called me and he said, "Ross, have you heard the news?" And I said, "Well, regard to what, Mr. President?" He said, "With respect to Prime Minister Holt perishing in a drowning accident." And I said, "Well, no, sir." He said, "Well, you better get my big airplane ready because we're going to have to leave tomorrow to go to the funeral." Prior to, this was in mid-ish December of 67. Prior to that, we had been down at Texas at his ranch over the Thanksgiving holidays. And during our visit there, I had visited with him and told him that, "Mr. President, your number one primary aircraft, this one number 26,000, is 4 months overdue for its biennial inspection, And it really needs to go into overhaul, so if you don't think you're going to be using the airplane for a while, I thought perhaps you might be able to let it go and we'd keep one of the backup planes for your use. And when I had told him that, I had also followed it up with a personal memorandum from me to him, more or less confirming what we had talked about. And I put on the bottom of my little memorandum, which rushed right over to him as soon as we got back to Washington after the holidays in Texas on Thanksgiving. I gave him two or three choices. See me, call me, yes, no, approve, disapprove. And all he had to do was check the memo and I'd get it back, which he did. He checked approved. I sent the airplane to New York for its overhaul. And so here I was faced with him telling me, get my big airplane ready. We're going to have to leave tomorrow. And I told him, I said, well, Mr. President, you may remember, sir, that I had mentioned to you that it needed to go into overhaul and that I had already sent it per your instructions or per your approval to New York to have the overhaul. He said, well, that's all right. Just call them up and tell them you'll be up there after a while to bring it home. So I said, but, sir, I was up there a couple of days ago, and I had been. I'd flown one of the Jetstars up to look at it and talk to the people that were working on it, the managers, about some things that we wanted done inside in particular. And I had seen the airplane scattered all over the hangar. You know, the gears were off and all the control surfaces were off and the wires were hanging down inside. And so I said, well, sir, they've got that thing dismantled and there's just no way that we could fly it back. He said, well, call them and tell them you'll be up tomorrow to put it back together and you can go get it in the morning. So I finally was able to convince him that there'd be no way that we could do that. And I told him or tried to convince him that what we'd do is try to make one of the backup planes, which, by the way, were not as flush inside. They were not the long-range versions of the airplane. They were the shorter range version. They would only fly about 10 hours nonstop, yeah. Whereas the principal airplane would go 14. Yeah. In other words, we could fly from Washington to Honolulu, stop for fuel, and then fly all the way on the rest of the way to Australia if we'd have had number one. But flying one of the backup planes, we would have to stop in California, we'd have to stop in Honolulu, stop in Pago Pago, American Samoa, and then on into Canberra, Australia. And he said, well, he said, those things are too noisy. And he said, you need to put some more soundproofing in them. And he said, those little slide-up windows on that Boeing airplane, said they always leak light through. And said, I want to be able to sleep on the way over, and we're going to be flying a lot during the daylight hours, and I want you to fix it so when you slide those windows down that you put some other cover over them so we can't see out or nobody can see in. And he said, also, I want you to get my big king-size bed here in the White House and fix it up and put it in that airplane. Well, oh, and he's still talking about we're going to leave tomorrow. Unfortunately perhaps, I never found Prime Minister Holt's body. And we didn't have to leave tomorrow, and so we did have a little bit of time to make all those modifications that he wanted us to make on board that backup airplane.
You remember we even took a riding bicycle if he could get up
and
ride. Oh, yeah,
exercise bike.
We did everything.
We strapped that down in the airplane. But lost my train of thought.
But what we did, how long it took us to finish out that flight. You know, we went on around the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to get to that. Okay. I need to tell some other details here in the meantime. And, of course, he said during the course of our conversation that morning, he said, Cross, I don't know why in the hell it is that every time that I want to do something or need to do something, you Air Force people can just screw it up royally. Now, that kind of ties into what Jack Belenny said and what George said. That was the kind of man he was to get along with. Well, we finally got airborne. We got off. We left from Dulles Airport, as I recall. We flew to Travis Air Force Base in California, refueled, just on the ground there 45 minutes or so, flew on to Honolulu and refueled and took off in a terrible rainstorm, and went to Pago Pago, landed there at night. And about 27 hours or 28 hours after we had left from Dulles, we finally arrived at Canberra. But just prior to arriving, I'd been sitting up front in the cockpit all night. The president had been asleep, of course, and he had some guests aboard. What were those people's names? Engelhart.
Charles W. Engelhart.
Engelhart Mining, yeah. Diamond Company.
And Platinum.
Anyway, I decided to get up out of the seat, walk back in the back, and get a cup of coffee because I was tired and needed to shave. I got back in the back, and there was the president standing there. And he looked at me, and I needed to shave by this time, and he said to Marie Famer, who was standing there, she said, or he said, "Boy, Cross, you look bad, don't you, Marie?" He said, "Are you tired?" I said, "Yes, sir, I am a little tired." He said, "Well, when we get to, how long before we get to Canberra?" I said, "About 35 minutes, sir. How's the weather?" "Well, it's good, sir." He said, "Well, when we get there," I said, "find yourself a hotel room somewhere," and said, "I won't need you for 24 hours. Of course, he might, because I'm the guy carrying the black football, so-called, which was all the world secrets and the nuclear response in case Russia attacked us and so on. But anyway, and he wasn't aware, of course, that we had, and we always did this, send out an advance plane, and all the Secret Service and all the communicators were there setting up telephones and radios and whatnot and getting hotel rooms for everybody. But he assumed that I'd be in some hotel out by the airport. But my room was always just two or three doors down from his, as was Paul's.
As was mine.
Anyway, he said, "You go get you plenty of sleep. Won't need you for 24 hours." So I did. I went and got in bed, took a bath first and got in bed, shaved. And I'd been sound asleep, I mean dead to the world, for about, I guess, 45 minutes. And the White House phone rang. He said, of course I knew his voice, I'd heard it so many times. He said, "Cross, where are you?" And I had a notion at that point to say, "Well, Mr. President, I was just sitting here waiting for you to call." But I didn't. I thought better of it. And I said, "Well, sir, I'm in my room." He said, "Well, come on over here. I want, where are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm in the Rex Hotel," which was just down the hall from him. "Come on over here. I want to talk to you." So I went over to the room where he was, the suite where he was, and inside was the president. He was laying up in bed reading and whatnot, reading the papers and doing whatever presidents do. And Jack Valenti, the guy I mentioned, who had left the White House but was along on this trip because he was still very close to the president. And plus the fact he was, as Paul, a Catholic and wanted to be sure that ultimately we went to Rome. Jack Valenti was in there. Walt Rostow, who was the National Security Advisor for the president, was in there. George Christian, who was the press secretary, was in the room. And Marvin Watson was in the room. And me.
Kind of chief of staff was Marvin Watson.
Yeah, he was chief of staff, Marvin Watson. And we were going to have a discussion about what the rest of the itinerary would be after the memorial service was held at Melbourne, which was going to be the following day. Well, I had known prior to leaving Washington that one of the things that he would especially want to do, even though he didn't say so, was to stop in Vietnam. I also knew, and he had told me this himself, that he might want to stop in Rome, but then he tried to mislead me and everybody else when he said, "But we may not do anything, but when we leave Australia, we might come back through Guam or Japan and come straight back to Washington." Well, that was his method to try to keep people off balance.
Yeah.
And I knew in my heart, from having known the man, and I'm sure you did, that we were going to go to Rome.
Right.
Because of the fact that the Pope at that time was trying desperately to help the United States and the world, for that matter, to get peace talks going in Vietnam about the Vietnam War.
And this is right around Christmas, too.
Yes. Another point. Well, nothing was really decided, but when I walked out of the room after we'd stayed in there maybe 30, 40 minutes talking, deciding, trying to decide, he said, "Well, Now, Cross, I know you'll go out of here and you'll tell everybody in the world. And he said, if we decide to go to Rome, said we'll probably have a communist demonstration at Rome. I said, oh, no, sir, Mr. President, I won't tell anybody. And I didn't even tell the press plane, the pilot of the press plane, a good friend, fellow Captain Doug Moody. Yeah. Well, when we finally left from Melbourne, we made a fueling stop in Darwin, Australia. And we took off from there, and we'd been instructed to head northwest towards Thailand, Bangkok. But don't let anybody know where you're going to land up there. There was a possibility we'd land at Udorn, a possibility we'd land at Bangkok. Korat, which was another base that we were running combat operations from, and Ubon. All four of those bases in Thailand, and my instructions were, after I talked to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General John P. McConnell, was to keep in touch with him by radio telephone, and he would tell us where to land because they were going to try to have a ceremony of arrival with troops and combat pilots and so forth. And so ultimately, about 30 minutes out of some landfall in Thailand, General McConnell called me on the radio phone and said, you're to land at Korat Air Force Base. Well, we landed there with absolutely no support. We hadn't sent any helicopters. We hadn't sent any, we had not previously sent any staff cars for the president. We had not even had a set of stairs over there so the president could get off this airplane. And pandemonium reigned supreme. We had a backup airplane for ourselves, another 707. We had our 707, and we had a DC-8 from Pan American Airlines, flown by Captain Moody. Along with all these F-105s coming and going on combat missions in the North Vietnam. Well, he was tired. We were tired. He got off the airplane, and he was mad at everybody. But he went on to the mess hall, I understand. I didn't go with him.
I went with him.
Did you?
Yes, sir.
Made a speech, and I think might have awarded a medal or two, and shook hands with a bunch of the pilots and the crewmen that were flying the combat missions. He came back, and he had a quarters that had been General Momar's quarters.
That's right. It was a trip.
And he was going to try to rest about 2 or 3 hours. And by the way, this was around midnight local time, and we really didn't know what else we were going to do, but I knew in my heart that we were going to leave and go back south and go to Vietnam and visit some troops in Vietnam. Anyway, he went down to this trailer, and the air conditioner didn't work. And so Marvin Watson went with him, his chief of staff. And Marvin, I guess, got his 6 o'clock fired on pretty hard.
Yeah, I was there.
You probably got it, too.
We got it.
And Marvin finally came back in a weapons carrier, kind of a vehicle, to the airplane. He said, Jim, you better get up there where the president was. So I jumped in whatever was available and went up there. And General Momar was the 7th Air Force commander at that time. And the president had just unmercifully fired on his 6 o'clock position. And General Momar wasn't accustomed to this, as some of us were.
That's a true story.
And he came out of that trailer house just as I arrived, and he was just shaking his head, and I thought he was about to cry. And so I told him, I knew General Momar, and I told him, I said, General, don't worry about it, sir. He won't remember this 2 hours from now, and even if he does, he's not mad. He just had to have an outlet, and you just happened to be there. Well, I walked on in, and then I got mine. He also told me that, well, Cross, be sure we got enough fuel. We're going to go back to down the coast of Cambodia until Cambodia wasn't friendly to us at that time.
No, it wasn't.
So we had to go off the coast south as far as we could until Vietnam came into view, and then we cut towards Saigon, and then from Saigon we had to head on towards Cameron Bay. Now, this is where it really gets interesting. Marvin Watson came into the cockpit, and he said to me, Jim, you got the medals? And I said, what medals, Marvin? He said, well, the president said you had the medals, and he's going to give distinguished service medals to all the generals that are and admirals that are running this war when we get on the ground in Cameron Bay. I have never heard a word about this. He said, well, somebody said that you're supposed to know. As it were. So he said, well, you better get some.
A little sidelight to that. He turned to me and said, Paul, get my ranch clothes out. I want my boots and those tans and everything so I can look like these military guys do in my khakis.
Exactly.
We're going to a funeral, and I had no idea. Ken Gaddis worked with me. Ken had the foresight to put those ranch clothes, and we had them. He thought that was great. See, yeah. Paul Glenn had the clothes, and Jim Cross didn't have the medals.
But let me tell you what we did. Fortunately, I had two very good friends in Saigon. One was the chief of staff for General Westmoreland. Became the superintendent of West Point a little bit later, three-star general. Bill Knowlton, good friend, and here I can't even think of his name. But anyway, I told our radio man, I said his name was Bill Justice. You mentioned him a while ago.
Yeah.
I told our radio man, I said, Bill, you lock up those two phone lines that we had. I don't care if the president wants to talk to the world or whoever. I need those two lines right now, and I want to call Bill Knowlton at MACV headquarters.
Yeah.
And I want to call Colonel Ernest Triplett. You remember Colonel Ernest Triplett, who is the military air transport commander on Thompson Newt Air Base. And I said, I got on the phone with Bill, and I said, Bill, I hate to lay this on you, bud, but the president is going to give distinguished service medals to all the admirals and the generals, and there was about six or seven of them involved. And he wants those medals when we arrive at Cameron Bay. And he said, well, I can get the medals for you, but what'll I do with them when I get them? I said, well, I've got a real good friend named Ernest Triplett down at the terminal. He said, yeah, I know Ernest. I said, well, you put them in Ernest's hands, and I told Ernest then on the other phone, I said, Ernie, when those box of medals come down from General Knowlton, you put them on the first airplane that's sitting on the end of the runway, the first MAC airplane, a MATS airplane, the transport. I don't care where the airplane's going. You divert it and send it to Cameron Bay with that package with my name on it. Ernie said, Roger, Jim, you got it. By that time, by the way, we're flying over Saigon. We could look down and see Saigon. And it's about 45 minutes, I recall, from there on to Cameron Bay. And so I'm biting my nails, sweating blood. And we get on the ground, and there's a little colonel. His name was Giannini. I'll never forget this little gentleman, the short, Italian-looking fellow. And I don't mean to offend the Italians here, but he was a little portly sort of a fellow, real friendly guy. Come up to me and says, anything I can do for you, Colonel? And I said, well, yes, I've got an airplane, I hope, coming in a few minutes with a box on it with my name on it, and I'm going to designate you, number one guy, you watch for those airplanes, and you get that box, and you come over there to that platform that the president has, or that they've set up for the president to speak, and bring me that box, and I've got to have it before the president concludes his speech. Well, I waited and had other chores to do and waited and waited and waited, no airplane, no box. In the meantime, the president had already made his tour of the hospital and toured the little patent-type jeep where he stood up and rode in front of the troops and stopped and talked to a few of the troops and finally came and mounted this homemade sort of a platform where they had a lectern so he could speak. And he made a speech, you know, and a fire and brimstone type speech about how these boys were doing such a wonderful job over there. And I'm still biting my nails and sweating that box, thinking any moment he's going to conclude the speech, and I'm not going to have the box. About that time, the president concluded the speech. Up runs the little colonel, and he's got the box. And Marvin Watson, bless his heart, and I were standing at the foot of the stairs at that podium. And, of course, I'm in uniform because that's one of my charges as military assistant to hand out the medals and help pin them on. And I'm tearing open the boxes, and I run up and present a medal to the president and help him put it on this general, you know, and run back and get another one. finished it all, and I thought, oh boy, survived one more test. And then he turned, and Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker was our United States ambassador to Vietnam, and he turned to Ambassador Bunker, and he said, "And Ambassador Bunker, you've done a wonderful job over here, and it is my privilege and my pleasure to award you the highest civilian award, the United States, the Medal of Freedom." And he turned to me like, "Where is it?" And I was crushed, of course. And I just kind of did that, you know. And he turned back to the podium and the press and the soldiers and Ambassador Bunker. And he said, "Mr. Ambassador, I'm so embarrassed to tell you this, but my military aid has failed me one more time." The ceremony, let me put one more point here. The ceremony was over at that point, and he came down and shook hands around and came down, and the airplane was sitting over here about 50 yards or so, and I'm sitting there, I'm still just crestfallen and crushed. And he, as he got come down the stairs, he said, "Come on." And he was in his ranch clothes, and so I fell in beside him, and he said, "What the hell happened?" And I said, "Well, Mr. President, sir, not by way of making excuses, but I said, I have no idea what Department of the Government handles the Medal of Freedom. So I'm sorry, sir, that I was unable to help you in this matter." And again, I'm going to use some of his very colorful language. He said, "Well, God damn it, Cross." He said, "At least you could have handed me an empty box to give him."
Let me tell you what he did do. I used to carry a briefcase, and everybody thought it was the secrets of the world. Matter of fact, the CIA director used to say to me, "I'll switch yours for mine," teasing him. Mine carried watches and pens and cigarette lighters and giveaways with the presidential seal on. So when he got back up into the room, he said to me, "Get me one of those watches."
Said what?
"Get you one of those watches."
Oh.
So that's what he gave to Ellsworth Bunker. And I'm sure he said, "Then the medal will follow." But
well, he did. In fact, he said it on the podium. He said, "Well, be assured, Mr. Ambassador, when we get back to Washington, you will get your Medal of Freedom." After he had, I won't say embarrassment, but I guess it was embarrassment. It certainly was a crushing blow to one's ego.
Take us on, heading towards Rome.
Well, we left from there immediately, and our flight plan called for us to stop in Karachi, Pakistan. And, of course, Karachi and India at that time were just like they are today. They were at odds. And we had filed what we call diplomatic overflight clearances already with India and everybody we were supposed to fly over. But as we approached the Indian coast about 50 miles out, we could see the coast of India up ahead. We'd been flying across whatever ocean or bay or gulf that is over there just in the belly of India. We got word from the Indian flight control system, airways control, that we were to land immediately, that we couldn't fly over their country. And the next thing you know, we were being intercepted by American-built F-86s. And so things were a little touchy at that point in time, and I called Paul or somebody, and I said, "Hey, get back there and get Walt Rostow up
here."
By the way, he was our national security advisor on the board. And I told Walt, I said, "Man, Walt, we're going to have to land, or we might get shot down or whatever, because India don't want us flying over their country." But fortunately, Walt called back to the White House, the Situation Room, which was his domain in the White House, talked to a man named Bromley Smith, who was the National Security Advisor Secretary. And Bromley Smith called Mrs. Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India at that time. And just as we began to cross the landmass of India, Mrs. Gandhi called off the dogs, and we were on in to Karachi. When we got to Karachi, the president of Pakistan, I believe it was Ayub Khan.
Khan at that time, yes.
Met the airplane, and we stayed there 45 minutes or so and refueled. And we filed our flight clearance for Madrid, Spain, because the president didn't want anybody to know we were coming to Rome. And by this time, I'm going to guess it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 23rd day of December. And I think the president had designs on us being in Rome, and he could be at the Vatican and meeting with the Pope on Christmas Eve. Well, we flew across Iran, and we flew across the Mediterranean, and when we were telling everybody that we were going to Madrid, and the Madrid people thought we were coming there. You know, the ground crews and whatnot at our base, I guess it's Tarragona over there was the name of it, thought we were coming there, and the general was all upset because we weren't going to let the president get off and visit with him and whatever. But just as we got past the tip, the boot tip of Italy, we changed our flight plan and ducked into the old airport. What was the name of that airport? Giampino, that's right.
That's correct.
We ducked into the old airport. Now, in the meantime, I had suspected way back in Washington that we were going to be going to Rome. And, of course, wherever we always went with the president, we tried to have an advance crew out there to set up
fuel,
stairs to get off the airplane and all those sorts of things, helicopters. And I had sent helicopters on a C-141 over there to be, we had to partially dismantle them, of course, to get them in the airplanes. They were to go into Aviano, Italy, be reassembled, and be available for the president when we landed in Rome. And the weather, however, was bad, and they were not able to get the helicopters dismantled or put back together. And so consequently, when we landed on this airport, first of all, we didn't have any stairs to get off. And you can't just throw a rope out the door and say, Mr. President, there's your get off, sir. So Joe Chappell, our flight engineer, went down the rope ladder and found one of those old maintenance stands, those old yellow maintenance stands that they used on C-124s or old big airplanes. And so we finally got the president off the airplane, and there wasn't a single automobile or car or helicopter or anything there to take him where he went. So he got back aboard. In the meantime, Marvin Watson and I were inquiring of some Navy-looking people, like our own Navy-looking people. So, are there any helicopters here? And this guy said, yes, sir, we got some old H-19s or some reciprocating type helicopters, old blue, greasy things. So we can't put the president on that. And Marvin and I said, yes, you can. I said, get it over here and get some pilots on it, and it's going to go first to see President Sarigat, I believe his name was.
About time.
To be politically correct. And then he was going to fly over to the Vatican and see the Pope on Christmas Eve morning, which would have been about 1 o'clock in the morning. Well, in the meantime, our helicopters that we'd sent over did, in fact, get put together and got test flown. And by the time he was ready to leave the Prime Minister's residence out in the mountains to come back to the Vatican, I sent Pete Rice over there with one of our regular helicopters.
And Colonel Pete Rice.
Brought him back to the Vatican, and everything went great. Got on the helicopter, came back to Giampino. In the meantime, we'd been refueled, and we were ready to go, and the president was beaming with happiness, and everything had gone well as far as he and the Pope were concerned, I suppose. He said it did, anyway. We took off, and we flew to 31,000 or 33,000, whatever. We were going right through the Straits of Gibraltar, about to level off, headed for Lodges in the Azores because we had to stop and refuel. Couldn't go nonstop back to Washington all the way. And so Joe Chappell said, President's coming in the cockpit. So here comes Johnson into the cockpit, sits down in the little jump seat right behind my seat. And he says, Colonel, have you done your Christmas shopping yet?
This is true.
And I said, well, no, sir, I haven't. He said, "Well, you know, I haven't either, Jim." And he said, "Me and my guests back here would like to do some Christmas shopping." He said, "Where are we going to land?" And I said, "Well, we're going to land in Lodges, the Azores, Mr. President." He said, "Do we have a base over there?" And I said, "Yes, sir, we do. We have a joint use base over there." He said, "We have a PX over there?" I said, "Yes, sir, we do. As a matter of fact, I've been in and out of there lots of times in my Air Force career." He said, "Well, call the commander down there." And this, by the way, is about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He said, "Call the commander down there and tell him the president needs to do some Christmas shopping and to open up the PX. I said, "Yes, sir." So I did. I called the wing commander down there, and we opened the PX in the middle of the night. And, there's one more little point here, and then I'm going to be through. When we arrived at Lodges, the Governor General of the Azor, of that section of whatever that island was called, Terciary, was on hand. And we had sent word ahead that we didn't want anybody to meet the airplane. The president was going to be asleep. And in this case, he wasn't going to be asleep. But he certainly didn't want to get off and talk to anybody, especially some guy. And I'm going to stand up now. This guy, I looked out the window, and he was dressed in a uniform and had these things, you know,
the epaulets.
And he had a sash across, had medals all the way down the front of his coat, you know, and had on this cap with all kind of scrambled eggs all over the top and around the bill and everything. And he was standing down there, and so Marvin Watson got off and went down to tell him, or actually lied to him, said, "Mr. Governor," and he didn't speak very good English, by the way. He spoke Portuguese, and certainly I didn't, or Marvin didn't speak any Portuguese. And Marvin got off and went down to tell this gentleman that the president was not feeling well and was asleep, and that he certainly couldn't come off. Well, the governor general didn't want to leave. So Marvin, again, wanted to pass the buck. He said, "Cross, put on your coat with the braids and so forth, and go down there and see if you can talk him out of leaving." So I had to face the music again, and I went down. I was able to get the guy to leave. And when he left, the Air Force brought a great big old school bus-type vehicle up, and the president, his guests, and all of the crew got on board that school bus and drove over the hill. If those of you have been to Lodges, you remember where the PX was down over the hill. Drove over the hill, and we shopped there for about 2 hours in the PX in the middle of the night.
There's a little side story to that, the human side of Johnson you hear about. He told Marie Famer and the other secretary, "I want you to get something for every one of the guys' wives. So when they arrive back at Andrews, if they couldn't do the shopping, they'll have something to take to their wife." And that's the kind of thing you never heard about Johnson, and that's what he did. He did things like that.
To conclude the story, we were gone slightly under 5 days on this round-the-world mission, 118 hours and 30 minutes, as a matter of fact, elapsed time. We were in the air 61 hours and 30 minutes on this tour, and nobody except Johnson got much sleep. When we got back to Andrews, and we're going with the sun, of course, as we went that way around the world, we got back to Andrews, as I recall, about 8 o'clock in the morning, Andrews time. And he got off the airplane. He's very, very happy about the whole trip. He said, "Well, that went well, Jim." He said, "Your crew and all the people done a fine job, and I thank him for that on behalf of the crew and everything." And he said, "Now, you go on home and enjoy Christmas with your family." And he said, "We won't be going anywhere for a while." I thanked him and wished him a Merry Christmas. This was Christmas Eve now. Got home with my family. We'd been gone 5 days, and so I was tired and went to bed for a little while. And then we got up, my family and I did, got up and went to Marlow Heights, I remember, to do a little Christmas shopping ourselves. And about, I don't know, it was around 5 o'clock on Christmas Day, when we had Christmas at home, of course, and I thought, well, we're going to have 2 or 3 more days off. On Christmas Day, he called about 4 o'clock and said, "Get my plane out. We're going to Texas." End of the story.
Let's show you a couple more pictures as we got. We got a couple more pictures, and we'll throw it open to some questions.
You bet.
This is across from where those chairs were, where we put the casket. This was one of the president's doctors and one of the president's speechwriters, and myself again. But that's the table where Mrs. Kennedy sat right across from the casket. She never left his side the whole flight back, except to come up for that short time when Johnson was sworn in. This is Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent that ran and caught the president's car and put Mrs. Kennedy back in the seat. Little gross, but what she was doing, there was a piece of his skull was on the back trunk of the presidential limousine she was going after. Clint did almost humanly impossible. They looked at Zapruder film and said he had to run faster than human can run to get on that plane and put her back in the seat. That's Clint Hill. This was one assistant press secretary, and the other one was Lem Johns, another Secret Service agent, myself. That's where we're sitting, the same place where she was, in the rear of the airplane. That's where usually the staff sat. It was back near the galley of the airplane. Okay, this is the famous picture of the swearing in of the president using Judge Sarah Hughes holding the Catholic missile, Mrs. Kennedy in her pink gown, congressman from Tennessee, from Texas rather, another congressman from Texas, Mrs. Johnson, Jack Valeni, a press secretary down near the place, and other people could get into. And this is what today we were walking through Air Force One. I told the general that this was a compacted area, and around this way is where the couch was. And that photographer I told you about, Cecil Stoughton, had to stand up in order to get this picture.
Paul, I think you made a mistake. That's Jack Brooks.
Jack Brooks from Texas, yeah. And this one I brought to give to my dear friend Jim Cross. They're going to make a copy and we'll send it to you later. This is a famous picture. The guy that's kissing the girl is John Glenn. We had flown down to Grand Turk Island, picked up General Cross and three or four of the other astronauts. The two fellows over near the airplane, that's me in the funny hat in the middle, Jim Cross and their co-pilot, and he's seeing his wife for the first time since he came back from orbit. And that's kind of a famous picture. And that's all the pictures I have. If you like, he's going to have the moderator. We'll take some questions, or if we can, maybe we can answer them. Maybe we won't be able to, but we'll try to.
I would find it very, very hard to believe that after this last hour that there might not be one or two questions out there amongst you. I certainly know, listening to this, and certainly what we've been able to enjoy, there'll never be a time that we won't maybe have a visit aboard Air Force One that we're not going to remember some of the really great human stories involved in this aircraft. Your question, sir.
General, you had to remove 550 people from your staff. How'd you do that without upsetting anyone?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
When you cut down how'd you do that?
The first thing I did was eliminate one helicopter squadron. I found when I got a grasp on what belonged in the military office over there, I found that they had a complete Marine helicopter squadron consisting of about 190 men and a complete Army squadron of the same size and equipped with maybe 10 or 12 helicopters of the same type, each squadron. And what they would do, they would alternate just so the Marines could say, well, we flew the president, and then the Army could say they flew the president. So I called the chief of staff of the Army, and I said, sir, we don't need your Army squadron. You can send it to Vietnam or wherever you might need it. And so we eliminated 192 people in one blow. I had, when I arrived in my office in the east wing of the White House, I think I had 25 people working there, and we cut that, I think, to 9, simply because we just had people kind of falling all over themselves. We had a lot of people working in these underground facilities at all the spots, and we had several of those. I'm not at liberty to say where they were or what was in them or anything, but nonetheless, we had a large contingent of people that were working to keep those things alive and keep the communications working and keep the beds and linens and so forth available and there and ready to use in the event, and the food supplies and the water supplies and that sort of thing. We looked at that and we were able to cut about 100 people out of that because they had assigned too many people to this job that didn't require nearly that sort of a task. And I don't recall now exactly, but we didn't quite reduce it by half. I think we decided that we got it down 43%, and that made him happy, so we didn't have to go quite to the extent that he had said.
Okay.
And we didn't get fired after 6 months. So.
Our next question over here.
Yeah, what was your salaries at the time, and what was the cost of the Air Force One when Johnson...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
The question is, what were your salaries at the time, and what was the cost of Air Force One?
Air Force One, in actual direct costs, not counting the self-insurance and the cost of the airplane and so forth, costs about, actually, and of course at that time, jet fuel was only 11 cents a gallon. And it cost, when I say Air Force One, I mean 26,000. It's only Air Force One when the president is aboard. If it's flying somewhere else without the president, it's not Air Force One. It's just number 26,000. But the cost on that will run about $700 an hour. The salaries for the crew, I remember telling someone yesterday that while I was the aide to the president and pilot as a colonel, a full colonel in the Air Force, my take-home pay was $1,150 a month. It's considerably more than that now for a colonel, but at that time, that's what I was able to take home.
960 is something like what mine was, 960.
Yeah, but that depended on how many dependents you had and what sort of...
Okay, next question.
Yes. I've noticed that when you go up the aft stairs to the airplane, there's a divider on your left. And I've noticed that instead of going straight up, it's got kind of a notch in it. And I was wondering, is that where they cut to get the casket?
You're very, very perceptive. It's exactly where they did. It's exactly where it was. Because we had to leave the top part in, which held the shelves where you had the overhead racks. You're exactly correct.
Okay, next question over here.
What was his relationship with the Kennedy family?
From what I know about it, he was not very, very friendly with Bobby. He was very, very close with the Kennedy children and Mrs. Kennedy. Matter of fact, he gave them a horse, a little pony for the John called Tex. He was very, very close with Mrs. Rose Kennedy. And they were very, very aware when they selected him to be the vice president. Bobby was strictly against it. But Jack Kennedy was smart enough to know he wouldn't get elected unless he had a southern fellow from Texas in. But the family relationship after the assassination was kind of aloof. But he called Mrs. Kennedy regular, asking if there was anything he could do, maybe he could help them with. And he pretty close, pretty close.
Okay, next question. Right here.
Yes, you mentioned the situation in Dallas with the number of crew between the two aircraft that you had to split up for the return trip. Given like your round the world flight, how many staff would you actually have on board in order to maintain? And I'm kind of driving at the fact that you talked about the number of stops that you made along the route, and that you were occasionally meeting with the dignitaries, whatever. Who was actually doing all the prep work while you were gone to the aircraft in order to continue with the rest of the flight?
The Pentagon advanced teams. Well, we did have advanced teams out. Let me make a point here. Whenever a United States president goes anywhere, but particularly overseas, it's a huge, huge task to make sure that communications are maintained for the president. The president has to be in touch with the world, with the White House, all the time, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Consequently, when the president's going to make a trip overseas, we, the military office, had to generate aircraft traffic that would take all of the advanced people that would be necessary to set up the hotel rooms, to set up the communications. Wherever the president went, there was always a complete switchboard, just like a switchboard in any big business. We had several operators and a portable switchboard that would go out and be set up and hooked into the local telephone system wherever it was, and they had radio receivers and radio patches that they could patch into the international radio network, the long-range networks. And nowadays, they even got satellite stuff that we didn't have back then, where they were able to use multiplex UHF and VHF radio, bounced off a satellite back to the White House or back to this switchboard, wherever it was set up. So, in other words, you had to send out a lot of people with cars, the limousines for the president, the helicopters that needed to be available, because we didn't have presidential-type helicopters wherever he would be going. So this was a massive effort, and still is, and costs a lot of money, a lot of taxpayers' dollars, every time our U.S. president moves anywhere. And I suspect now that it's
bigger,
considerably bigger than it was when we were in that
role. Here's our next question.
Yes, for the sergeant, who was the Air Force chief steward on Air Force One when during Johnson's?
Joe,
what was the question?
Who was the chief steward during Johnson? That would be
Ed White.
Ed White, Chief Master Sergeant Ed White. He had flown in the 89th there for a lot of years, and went on when we formed our crew. Jim Cross 15 to go on. He's a good man. Okay, next question back here then.
You mentioned Mrs. Kennedy's motivation for going out on the back of the limousine after the shooting, and I'd never heard that before.
Well, that's a little inside that I got from Clint Hill. We asked Clint, what were you trying to do? The president had already been shot. He couldn't. He thought she would be ejected off the rear of the car as it accelerated. And when he got there, he saw what she was trying to do.
I see. Do you know if that's ever been published before?
No, it hasn't.
I've never heard that.
No, it hasn't. Have you read it?
In Dealey Plaza last Sunday, there was a gentleman selling a book that he wrote, and he was telling us about what Jackie was doing, and I believe it was in the book as well as he was telling us about it. And then we went into the sixth floor museum and expected to see it there, and we looked very carefully at the display of Clint Hill and Jackie and the series of photographs, and nothing was mentioned there in the museum. And we went back out to see if we could look at the publication, and the gentleman was all packed up and ready to go, so we didn't pursue it. But my husband and I are very interested that you brought it up tonight, because it's something we hadn't heard before.
There's a good book if you read it. There's so many books written on it. You can put something in that's controversial, it'll sell books. But there's one written by Jim Bishop. His background, Jim Bishop wrote some books like The Day Christ Died, The Day Lincoln Was Shot, so he's a very famous author. He autographed one and sent it to me while I was working at the White House. In my opinion of reading so many of them, he runs it minute by minute of the people he interviewed, what happened, and how we had some confrontation on the airplane because of ethnic background, being the Southern Baptist and the Irish Catholic, and the feeling of their man was taken from under him, and here's this upstart Johnson taking over the presidency, with irregardless of what the Constitution told us to do. Matter of fact, General McHugh went forward and told Jim Swindell, get this plane out of here. Mac Kilduff, press secretary, walked and said, wait a minute, the new president's going to get sworn in. Well, here's this, I outrank you, I'm a brigadier general, you'll get this plane in the air. Poor Jim Swindell, quiet southern gentleman from Florida.
No. He's from Alabama.
Alabama, too? No, he's an Alabama guy. Okay. But this is the kind of tension, and people saying, why is it happening? This thing was happening minute by minute by minute, and you're making decisions that we didn't know what was going on. We're inside of an airplane. We hadn't heard all the news that you were hearing over television. So some of these things of why they were happening is unbelievable how very, very professional men carried out their duties and responsibilities. Little thing to bring up. You heard of us say I and me and General Cross and this. We had a tremendous crew that we flew with. We never had to look over our shoulder to worry about anything these guys did for us. We had an outstanding ground crew. We saw them over there polishing an airplane today, and he and I remembered our pride in that Air Force One is we would go down there as a crew, officers included, take polishing metal, and we would shine that airplane. It was our airplane. We wanted to have the best. That's the kind of crew, and I'm still sure that's the way the crew is today. Oh, they got more plane to work on. But it's a tremendous job. There's a very few of us that got the high honor to work there. And one of the reasons I wanted to come out and talk about it, and I'm sure he has, I'm going to talk, I'd be remiss. My daughter and her husband and two grandchildren are back here. One of them's in the fourth grade, and I'm going to talk to the fourth grade tomorrow at his school. But the pride of having been there, I feel an obligation that I have to say something about it and pass it along. And I was just delighted to come out here and do it. I used to speak in front of Air Force One before it come back to school kids at Andrews Air Force Base. And I used to turn and say, I met this lady when she was young, back in 1962. And now here she's outlasted me in the Air Force, and she's ready to retire. A matronly lady coming out here to be taken care of. We just love that airplane. Sure did.
Well, gentlemen, you've given us some really wonderful memories tonight. Our evening is coming to an end, but it's certainly our custom to, as you share memories with us, to leave you a little memory of your visit here with us.